All right, here we go. One more time. Bantha Fodder, episode 10. I'm Mike Kamate.
And I'm Jacob Tender.
Welcome. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome back. This is episode 10. That's a two-digit number there. That's not bad. It means we've been doing this for, what, about 20 weeks?
Yeah, we're doing two a month, I think. if we can get this out by the end of the month, which I fully believe I can do this, and if this is posted on June 1st, I'm really sorry, you guys.
I think you can do it. You've been turning them around a lot quicker.
Yeah, it's amazing what doing something teaches you how to do, you know?
Exactly. Doing it more frequently and upgrading equipment, which we've been doing steadily every single episode of the show so far. So
I don't think there's been one episode where we had the same piece of equipment.
This is my second time doing the same exact setup.
Even with the boom?
I have not changed anything. Yeah, I had my boom arm for the last episode. Everything's
wow.
Exactly the same. But this is the first time that I've duplicated a setup.
We're so professional.
Yeah. I guess if you want to count my window being open, that's a difference, but it's really hot in
that's
here.
That's a different setup. Yeah, the soundproofing.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, I've probably got a little bleed here, but
you're going for a room noise.
Yeah, I'll get some atmospheric noise in here.
If I gave you atmosphere, you would have a garbage truck outside, the couple yelling downstairs, the neighbor's kids screaming outside at 11 p.m. And
remind us of where you live.
I live in Brooklyn, New York. It'd be funny if I was like, no, I live in a rural, some rural setting.
I think last episode was the best that we've done as far as sound quality goes. I'm really happy with my mic, and I know you are too. Just
I'm happy with your
standpoint.
Mic. Good yeah. Lord, if I have to edit out one more whine from a cable or something like that, jeez.
Yeah, I sent that back. I sent my Yeti back to Blue last week, so I'm waiting for them to get back to me and let me know exactly what's going on with it, if anything.
No trouble found. Send it back to you. It's your fault. User error.
Yeah, basically. I don't know. I don't imagine that they won't find anything wrong with it. I mean, like I told you earlier, I recorded an episode of another podcast that I'm trying to get started with a buddy, and he used his Yeti, and he sounded amazing. It sounds really good. No whine, no buzzing, really good, loud sound, but it's nothing like mine, so I sent mine back in. And hopefully they can fix it. If not, I will take the refund. It'll help me get some more gear for my current setup, which I'm totally stoked about.
Sweet.
Yeah. All right, Mike. So what's new? This is it's only been a week and a half since we recorded last episode.
Yeah, I mean, even before we recorded last episode, I had this week's all set up because I finished Aftermath. What's up, dude?
You finally finished it. I mean, it only took you
three months. Definitely.
I mean, you started it right after we did the Jason Fry book episode, right? The one after Weapon of a Jedi?
Yeah, I was like super stoked to read something that was written for not children. And
and you picked up Aftermath.
Honestly, I dove into this book thinking that it was going to have the Battle of Jakku in it. And I, again, just got that one confused. It's weird that I do that.
No, that's
Lost
Stars.
I know. And I would have chosen Lost Stars if I had known.
Which is great.
Yeah.
That's my favorite one so far.
Don't rub it in, all right?
It's all right. You finish this one here. We're going to talk about it tonight. You're going to read, what, Bloodline next?
Bloodline, because someone said it has to do with Force Awakens. And after this book, I just need something to link to what matters in this universe. Because, as you'll find out tonight, I am a fan of this book, Aftermath. But, I don't know. We'll get into it. I just can't.
There's a lot to talk about. This book contains a lot.
Oh my god, so much. There's just so much in this book. This is like I don't know if anybody's read like House of Leaves, but this is House of Leaves Star Wars version of it. This is just...
What is House of Leaves? That sounds familiar.
It's like a cult.
Is that the one that had like all the extra like material with it and like the scribbles on the margin?
There's a couple. No, that's I know what book you're thinking of. There's definitely some margin work in House of Leaves, but it's a labyrinth of a book, both in subject and in layout. But this book is more traditional in layout, but almost as labyrinthine as just...
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff kind of like weaving in and out of this book. And it's going to... I think this might be a little hard to follow along with in this episode. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to structure this out, but we're going to give it a rush out and try to hit all at least the kind of important points.
Yeah. I mean, let's start with their author. I think it's always a good spot to kind of talk about is just where this book is coming from. And you looked into the development of this one.
So yeah, Aftermath was written by Chuck Wendig. And it's kind of interesting because on September 4th of 2014, Chuck Wendig tweeted about wanting to write an officially licensed Star Wars book. He has some friends, primarily Gary Whedon and Jason Fry, who relayed this message on to one of Del Rey's editors at large who had read one of his fantasy novels and thought that they should give him a shot. So sure enough, they gave him a go, and 45 days later, he had the book written. On September 4th, 2015, the book was released. So exactly a year after his tweet expressing an interest in writing an officially licensed Star Wars book, he released an officially licensed Star Wars book called Aftermath.
What was your take on this one? You said it seems like it.
Well, you know, I think that's great. It's a cool story. You know, it makes it seem like anybody who has a good idea could, you know, contribute something to the canon story. But what really threw me off was that it only took him 45 days to write it.
Yeah.
And to me, I think it shows.
I mean, as an artist, you know, or relatively speaking, I write music, and sometimes my best music comes out really quickly. You know, like a session will take me a day, like, or lyrics will just pour out in, like, you know, a couple hours, as opposed to like spending months on something.
Right.
So I can definitely appreciate having like crazy inspiration and just diarrhea-ing words all over your word processor.
And I think that's what happened. I mean, I'm not totally hating on this book. I think that there's some good parts to it. I just feel like it wasn't completely finished. I feel like some of it was sort of confusing. I think that the structure of the book didn't lend itself well to the storytelling that he was trying to get across, because he's trying to get a lot of information out there. And I think it'll probably all pay off once the trilogy has ended, because this is going to be a three-part series. With Aftermath being the first, Aftermath Life Debt being the second, and then a third following that, I think sometime next year. But I don't know. I think with especially his writing style in this book and the order in which he presented the information, I found it really hard to figure out what it was I was supposed to be paying the most attention to. And I think it was really distracting.
I think that's what took me so long to finish this book, is just the idea that there's just so many characters. And there was never a point where I was like, you're never latched onto a character for more than, you know, a chapter.
Yeah, because it changes just about every chapter. It changes the perspective.
Sometimes in between, there was a couple of points in between in the same chapter where it'll do a line break, and then you're into another character's perspective. But that, and you just can't focus on that one character for, like, because it's just like changing a channel. You're just channel surfing here with this story. And, you know, I guess that's what kind of the movies do. You know, like the movies jump from scene to scene, especially during like big battle sequences. There's always a bunch of things. So I think that was true to form as far as Star Wars goes.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I think this book was written a lot like a screenplay.
Absolutely.
I think it was written with that sort of mentality in mind. And if you're able to kind of envision that as you're reading, it probably helps quite a bit. That's not how I read. So I think this is a little jarring for, you know, the way that I generally read, or the books that I generally pick up. Mm-hmm. But I think it has that sort of air. And having kind of, you know, questioned you about it over the past few months to see where you're at with it, I think the way you read it was a lot like the way that I read it, in that the first half of the book took a really long time. And then towards the end, once things started coming together, it was a lot easier to get through, because, you know, storylines started kind of coming together. You kind of knew exactly what was important and who were you supposed to be following. You knew the characters a little better because it was revisiting them a couple more times, where in the beginning, you know, you're just going from one character to another, to another, to another, to another, to another. Some of them not even part of the main storyline. And you're just like, well, which one am I supposed to be following here? Like, which is the actual story? Am I going to be coming back to this at all, or is this the only time this is mentioned in the book? So I think it was kind of a hard read. I think reading it through a second time would probably be a lot easier, and I'm going to, hopefully, before Life Debt comes out. But
it's not that I hate Wendig's style. I actually really enjoy it. I think when I started the book and I kind of conferred with you about your thoughts briefly, you kind of said like you didn't like his writing style. I really like the way he writes. I love his use of present tense. I really love his point of view, his perspective on this, the third person limited. He's in individual characters' minds, and this is no omniscient narrating. This is just strictly one person's minds, and it's everything. It might as well jump into first person at some points. It's so in these characters' minds and feelings. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy that kind of thing because it kind of gives us like an inside the box look at like what a character would be like if we're looking at this in terms of a movie. The sentence fragments, you know, stream of consciousness, there's like, they say like, you know, like it's like he did this, like that, blah, blah, blah. Like they're just some really great sentences that feel like they're the product of somebody my age. And I'm not sure how old Chuck Wendig is, but he's got to be close to us. And you know, it just, I felt like I was reading something by a peer, which is nice to read, you know, like kind of like a new school of writing, you know, nothing like super avant-garde or like abstract, but definitely.
Yeah.
He's writing for like millennial speak, you know, these are text messages basically that he's writing. But with that kind of fragmentation comes just infinity characters. As soon as you started throwing all these characters, I was brought back immediately to eighth grade reading The Call of the Wild. Did you ever read that?
I did not, no.
It's a book about like dogs in some, you know, cold place. They're all sled dogs and they're all, you know, it's just about a bunch of dogs. And there's like 15 or 16 dogs, and they all have individual personalities, individual names. And we had to make index cards in class. And every time something in the book would happen to one of those dogs, we'd jump to the buck index card and write down blah, 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 got into a fight. He's dominant now, or like he's submitting to the whatever, Solex. Mm-hmm. That's one of the other characters. But yeah, it just that's what I felt like I had to do with this book, is I just needed index cards, and so that the notes function on my reader came in real handy on this one, or else I would not remember anything by the time I got to the end of the book.
Yeah,
it just took so long for anything to solidify with these characters. Like I went half the book without remembering the characters' names, just because of all the interludes that get thrown in.
So many interludes.
Which it, you know, like I get it. But even in a Star Wars film, these would have no place, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're just kind of like, it's just like off in, you know, another world. You know, it's like, like I said earlier, I think a lot of this is going to come together when the series wraps up. Once the three books are out, I think a lot of that is going to make sense. So having read through it the first time, I think a second read through the series will be kind of great, you know, kind of get that full story and you have all of it in your mind already. I think that'd be nice, but reading through the first time, and especially just in the first book, having so many, you know, strings to follow, it's really difficult. And you know, I was thinking about my notes on this book, and I don't have them anymore because I did it on a rented copy through the library, so all my notes were wiped. But I hated the fragments, and I don't remember a lot of my notes, but I remember that most of them were just me highlighting sentence fragments because they were annoying the crap out of me. And I couldn't, like, it would literally take me out of the book. And a lot of the writing that you're saying that you enjoyed and, you know, something that made you feel a little more connected to the book because of the way it was written really just drew me out of it. And when I'm reading a fiction, especially in sci-fi or fantasy, I want to be in that world because it's already so much different. You know, it's different from the world that I live in. So I want to dive into that fully and just, you know, kind of take in everything as I'm reading. I don't like being lifted out of that by sentence fragments and weird streams of consciousness that are, you know, distracting and not super pertinent to the story or the plot. And I feel like there was a lot of that in this book. So for me, I don't know. I think that the way that he wrote it in the present tense and, you know, in third person, I think that's technically a really cool accomplishment. I think he did a good job with that because I mean, I know that I struggle writing in the present tense when I'm kind of tasked to do so. But, you know, from a reader's standpoint, I didn't enjoy a lot of the book because of the way that it was written. And really, that's my only gripe, because the story was fine. I actually liked the story quite a bit. I think most of my qualms with the book just come from Chuck Wendig's writing style as far as this book goes.
I feel like you're a real stickler for grammar, because I teased you about this today, but you are the type of guy that puts a period at the end of every text message you send.
Yes, I do. And I get really confused when people don't send me periods. I don't know what that means.
I used to do it too, until I had my friend Maggie. She called me out on Facebook, and like totally random. I had no idea I was doing this. She's like, all right, this is for you, Mike Comite, you period texter. And I was like, what the f-? Like, what are you saying? Like, and I read the article she links, and it's about how when you put a period at the end of your text messages, you sound really angry.
That's funny. My dad texts in all capital letters because that's all he can read on his phone. Oh, he doesn't know that he can turn the things up, or when I suggest it to him, he says, no, I don't need that. He just types in all caps, and that goes on Facebook.
That would require him to do something, though. He would have to, that's like my dad. He puts ellipses, but my dad puts ellipses between every single thing, because I think he hits the space bar twice and he has the auto period, and then he just puts in two more just for the hell of it. This is called Dads on Technology, this new podcast we're starting.
I have people at work that email me the same way, with ellipses in between sentences, and I think that comes across as condescending.
Are they 70 years old? Like these people?
No, they're like, you know, 40s.
It's like a different generation thing. I've read like historical documents with, you know, people using ellipses and like letters to their friends. And I think it's like a product of when my dad was growing up. I don't know.
Maybe. I'm really comma heavy, but you know, we all have our problems. And I think Chuck Wendig has a lot of them. See how I segued that right back into the conversation there?
It lets me not cut it out. I'm all in for it. I mean, speaking of Wendig, like the last thing I want to say about Wendig's writing style is just like the narrative devices he uses, you know, aside from tense perspective fragments, it kind of takes you out of the book also when you are able to recognize plot devices. I'm not talking about like Deus Ex, you know, Machina or something like that. More about like, there's multiple points in this book where he pulls a gotcha kind of feel. And mm-hmm. do you remember that? Like, so there's at least
Which
three
time?
Points. Yeah, that's what I mean. There's at least 3 points in this book where he's like, they died. And then you turn the page, you start the next chapter, and it's like, just kidding, man. He's not dead. Like, but that's the thing is he on the page, it literally says like, Wedge Antilles is face down at the back of the room, dead. And then, like, two sentences later, he's not dead after all. Like, Wendig knows exactly how to make your gut just drop and just be like, oh, they killed Wedge Antilles? Oh, my God. And that's not even the only time Wedge almost dies in this book. Wedge, like, in the opening, he detonates, like, he does a self-destruct on, like, some freighter he's flying. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, he's dead. There's no way he could have survived that one. Oh, and then, gosh. Sure enough, he's scurrying around the vents of the Star Destroyer he infiltrated. One of the other characters, Nora, you know, we'll get into all these people are in a minute, but, you know, it's just like, and then she's gone. And you're like, oh my God, she's gone. Next chapter, she walks in the door. She walks in the door the next chapter, just like singed. Like her fighter just went down in a ball of fire, and then she walks through the door the next thing. Turns out that thing had an ejector seat after all, is, again, the word.
Oh, my gosh.
On the page.
Yeah, I mean, he keeps doing it. He did the same thing with Temen.
Well, Nora dies again at the end, and then she comes back to life. And then Temen is dead. That's another word. Like, and then Temen gets thrown off a balcony later on in the book. Like, he just loves killing. And I guess that's like, I don't know.
No, he doesn't. He likes making his readers think that they're killed to give it some weight.
Right.
He doesn't follow through. Not actually killing them. He's just pissing me off.
Yeah, I guess. Every time
I was just like, God damn it.
What is my note? It says, when Nora dies the second time, but doesn't die, before I had found out that she's not dead, I wrote down, if she's not dead this time, I'm going to fucking flip out, is my literal note. Like, there's just so much anger at him not killing these characters.
It's annoying.
It is.
I really don't like that. If there's anything I really don't like in fiction writing, it's that, like,
being too nice to your characters.
Yeah, too nice to your characters. You know what? Like, if you're going to do that, like, once in a book, fine. But don't keep doing it. It's overplayed. I mean, he does it 3 to 4 times in this book alone.
I can see, you know, like, from a cinematic perspective, you know, like, Empire Strikes Back, Luke lets go when Vader has him cornered in that big air shaft thing. Mm-hmm. Then you're like, whoa, he just fell off a cliff. So, like, I could see the novelization cutting, like, and then Luke let go and drifted into the abyss. And, like, chapter ends and you pick up, like, a few sentences later. And it's like, Luke is hanging, like, he went down a shaft. He's actually alive. Like, I can see where Wendig is coming from, because that's such a cinematic thing to do, is to, like, fade to black. Your character must be dead. Oh, it turns out he's still alive, you know?
Yeah, but it feels to me that he's just trying to test our care about these characters. And it's like, okay.
Which works in a movie.
You didn't really build them up enough for us to care. So are we supposed to care, or are you just, like, killing them off? And it didn't work for me. Like, I wasn't invested enough in these characters to be like, oh, that's devastating.
How could you be invested in these characters? They're just, right. You barely get a glimpse of them. You get a little bit of them, like a little sassafras in one scene, and then you're off to the next one. And
so for me, it's like, oh, they're gone. Okay. Well, you know, they played their part. I'm just, okay, I'm moving on with the story. Oh, she's back. Oh, okay. Then what was that whole thing for?
There's no weight to anything that's going on in this book. Even though this is supposed to be the most weight that there can be, you know, like, this is post-Battle of Endor, this book is taking place. This is the fall of the Empire, the last remnants, and something big is going on this planet called Akiva. I mean, just digging into this plot, you know, I had super, super high hopes going into it. And again, I want to say they weren't, like, destroyed, you know, by this book. Like, all in all, not disappointing, but... You know, this opening scene for me in this book was so awesome. I like it's I mean, there's another interlude which I thought fit well, and I thought I could see that opening like something like Rogue One, or like open like just kid, like a bunch of people just throwing rocks at an Imperial thing, like a statue, pulling down a statue of the Emperor. Like, I thought that was an appropriate way to start a book, but every interlude that followed was kind of a bummer. But I really like seeing that opening scene. And then launching into this kind of thing where Wedge Antilles, you know, the hero of Battle of Endor, who shot down the Death Star core, he comes out of hyperspace on this planet Akiva. He's just scouting for Imperials. And I saw it as such a great opening scene for a Star Wars movie. You know, like the crawl goes away out into the recesses of the stars, and it pans down, and we have Akiva, and Wedge Antilles drops out of space. And one of the things that he describes, Wendig describes, is just Wedge is just like chilling in outer space, thinking about his time, you know, outside the rebellion. And this Star Destroyer just drops out of hyperspace, like totally unexpected. And what I was thinking about it, like outside the context of a John Williams score, and just like having something that massive just fall out of hyperspace in front of you outside a planet when you're not expecting it. Just like such a giant space vessel just falling in front of you. No sound because it's outer space, and there's no like orchestral hit. It's a really powerful image to me. It's how I imagine you feel when you watch the Rogue One trailer and you see that Star Destroyer.
Yeah.
Oh God, you love that Star Destroyer.
Coke White Star Destroyer.
Yep. You're hooked. But that's what I think of, and I thought, like, that just jazzed me up so much, because it's not like a dogfight. We're not talking about, like, high action.
He's just cruising.
This is just, like, really powerful imagery, and I thought, I was super stoked about that. And then it becomes really apparent really quickly that you are going to be dealing with way too many characters, and that Wedge Antilles is not the main character of this. I would have a hard time even classifying Wedge as a side character in this because of how little you see him in this book.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of hardly in it for a majority of the book.
Yeah. I mean,
they put him in there at the beginning, and then they put him in there at the end.
They sprinkle him in throughout the whole thing too. But I mean,
just like little updates.
I mean, if you were to go through, like, the plot lines in this book, like, you have a couple threads running alongside one another. You have Wedge's plot, which is basically infiltrating this... I mean, I guess the setting itself. A planet, Akiva, just seems like a planet. like any other. It's not like a mining planet. It's like a pretty green planet in my imagination, like a civilized Endor almost, you know, like there's cities.
Yeah. This is just a, you know, it's an out of the way outer rim planet that's just kind of like chilling, you know. They have their own little mini government there that has its dealings with the Empire, but is mostly self-contained, and it really has really nothing to do with the major plots of the story so far. It's just kind of out of the way, which is why the Empire decided to have this big secret meeting there.
That's kind of the whole overarching setting of this book, is just this Imperial meeting that's taking place on Akiva, mm-hmm. and the various parties that become entangled in it for various motivations. Like, you have Wedge's plotline, who is he's happened to just stumble upon this meeting, and he's infiltrating, and he's basically trying to get the word out so the Rebel fleet can come and destroy them, the Imperials, that is. You have this other pilot, Nora Wexley, a Y-wing pilot from the Battle mm-hmm. of Endor. I liked her, you know, her kind of PTSD flashbacks to the Battle of Endor. You know, because they're thinking about trying to leave the Death Star as it's exploding. You know, I've played the video game X-Wing Alliance, and there's the last mission of that game is you're fleeing a burning Death Star, and you have to get out before the explosion overtakes you.
Isn't that scary? I mean, it's very frightening. That scene always gripped me as a kid, you know, especially in the first one, like when they're flying away from the thing and it explodes. I'm just like, come on, get away. You know, it's like
big one.
Running away from anything that's exploding. Like, it's supposed to kind of push up that anticipation level and get your heart pumping a little bit. Are they gonna make it?
Yeah, and that's why I really, you know, I thought Nora was great, you know, as far as the character goes. And her plot line is she is coming back to mm-hmm. Akiva to find her son, to reunite with her son. Is that why she's there? Or she's not on Rebel business, right?
Yeah, no, that's why she's going back. No, I think she's kind of like, she's hitchhiking with some, you know, just freighters or
smuggler,
something.
He's a smuggler, yeah, trying to get her in.
Some smuggler, and just to get back on the planet, and she gets there to find her son and hopefully take him away from this planet now that the Empire's falling.
And then the son has his own plot line, which is basically right. he was abandoned by his mother, Nora. His name is mm-hmm. Temin, otherwise known as
Snap Wexley.
Your favorite.
He's great, man. I mean, this is a character that we saw in The Force Awakens. This is one of the first kind of tie-ins to The Force Awakens that we get in the written canon. So you get this little boy, Temin, who grows up to be this big Snap Wexley guy who ends up being the number one recon man for the Resistance.
Which I was bummed when you told me that it was Snap Wexley. I didn't put the last names together. And uh-huh. and when you're like, oh, yeah, well, I was like, well, there's no stakes in this because it doesn't
there
tie
no
in.
Tie-ins.
There's no tie-ins to The Force Awakens. You're like, well, yeah, it does, the main character. And I'm like, who? He snaps. I was like, oh, well, now I know Temin doesn't die. Come on.
Yeah, I guess that was an inadvertent spoiler on my end. Sorry about that.
It's okay. It doesn't matter. I mean, I was fooled because Wendig said he died like 3 times.
Yeah. Well, he's in there and he's kind of neat. I think Temin was a neat character because, you know, like you say, he's kind of left there on this planet as a kid while his mom goes off and fights this war. And he doesn't really know, you know, what's going on with her. He was just left there with, what, his aunt? I think it's his aunt.
His aunt.
And yeah, his aunt and her wife.
Yeah.
It's one of the more major contributions to the Star Wars universe that Wendig kind of, you know, pushed in there for us. He gave us some LGBT characters. And, you know, not just these two. He added some more as well. I think that's great.
One of my favorite characters, Singer. He ends up, he's a gay man. It's great. He's an Imperial loyalist officer mm-hmm. That just happens to be on Akiva while this is all taking place. But he's a deserter.
He was at the Battle of Endor. He was on the planet. He wasn't in the sky. He was on the planet at the time. But after that, he deserted, and he seems to be hiding out here, drinking a bunch of nasty grog and bars, just hanging out.
It seems like his plot line is just, it's not really as defined as any of the other characters. His motivation is not really made clear until close to the end when he kind of just says, like, they're like, well, what are you, a rebel or an Imperial? And this guy mm-hmm. goes, he's like, I'm in it for me. I'm right. me, and I'm in it for me. So, you know, he's just like kind of like a neutral character. And
well, he just got dragged into it, you know?
I mean, he
really didn't choose to be involved, but I think selfishly he got involved because of another character, Jazz.
Chaz. This is, again, we're up to character number four here. Fourth plot line going on. This is a bounty hunter who also is at the Battle of Endor, I guess, which is kind of a weird coincidence.
Yeah, she was on the ground at the same time. I'm not quite sure why, but she's a Zabrak, and this is like the same race as Darth Maul and Savage Opress, from the same planet. And she seems pretty cool. She's there to take a bounty on... one of the people meeting up at the IFC meeting, that's the Imperial Future Council, where basically any of the remaining leaders of the Empire are kind of meeting up to decide what exactly is going to happen now that all of their big guys are dead. So she's there to like take somebody out. She notices that there are a bunch more bounties that could be had here. So instead of taking out the one, she decides that she's going to boldly try to take them all. And then at some point, you know, Singer kind of meets up with her and recognizes her from the Battle of Endor. And he has a soft spot for Zabraki women, apparently. So he kind of teams up with her a bit and gets dragged into this greater story with Temen and Nora and Temen's droid Mr. Bones.
I really kind of like the weird non-romance that happens between Singer and Jazz. You know, like, they're setting it up basically to reveal Singer is gay. And, you know, Jazz is like a robot. She doesn't have human, like, she doesn't process things like a human. And she's just like, yes, we can mate after this is all over. You know, like, yeah. I you're a suitable mate for me. And Singer's like, no, I'm really not into women. And, yeah. and she's like, oh. It was kind of a funny, like,
So why, since Singer is gay, why did Wendig set up the Singer Jazz thing so much? Why does Singer have such an interest in Jazz? Is it just because coincidentally they were both at the Battle of Endor and now they're both on this planet?
Yeah, I think they're trying to do a whole like serendipity kind of thing here where, you know, he's just like seeing it as a calling. I mean, they go through Singer's character is one that, you know, he at the Battle of Endor, he found himself alive at the end of it somehow, and he realized how lucky he was, and he saw that he was on the losing side for a reason. Mm-hmm. And part of that realization was seeing Jazz, I believe, you know, kind of just somebody who wasn't a part of the Imperials that kind of made it out at the end. And I think he has aspirations to be like her as far as not tied to anything. Mm. And that's a piece of his past, I think, that he also sees. You know, maybe she's a threat to him because she knows he was an Imperial Loyalist officer. Or maybe she doesn't. I don't really know.
Maybe he just wants to see what she knows or something. It wasn't really clear. You know, this book kind of reminds me of Lost in a few ways. There are a lot of storylines. It's hard to decide what you're supposed to be following. And in most cases, it doesn't really matter. Because
it doesn't go
you're
going to
follow the big ones. And some of them are just going to kind of trail off. And maybe they'll tie them in the last few episodes.
I mean, were there any other... Okay, so there are more storylines here.
Basically, we've got Wedge, we have Temen and Nora, Jazz, Singer, Rey Sloane for the Empire side.
Tell me about Rey.
Yeah, Rey Sloane's pretty sweet. She's becoming one of my favorites in the like the new canon. She has not been in a movie yet. She hasn't appeared on screen in any way, but she has been in the comics. She was in A New Dawn by John Jackson Miller, and she was in this book. And she is, what is she? Is she a commander, or is she a general?
She's General Rey Sloane.
Rey Sloane. So yeah, she's, you know, she's pretty high up in the Empire at this point, considering that most of them are dead. And she's kind of taking over at this meeting, trying to keep everything in line and try to keep the Empire from falling apart. Because at this point, there's just splinter groups that are trying to take control where there's opportunity to take control. They're not in it for the Empire itself. They are after selfish means, and they're after power and they're after wealth. So she is trying to keep things together the best that she can. And
she's the only one that has her head on straight. She's the only one that's seeing saving the Empire as a valuable thing besides, you know, like money, power. She's just seeing like this political, it's like, I just see it as someone who's like, this political party is really important and we can't let it fall apart in faction. It has to be one unit or else.
Well, she's a loyalist, whereas the others are, you know, they're hardly even members of the Empire. You know, a lot of the people that are in this meeting are more or less just like money backers, you know, people that help produce weapons and that sort of thing. They're not necessarily in it for the Galactic Empire's cause. They're just you know, they're in it for themselves. They're in it for the wealth and for the power. So she's trying to keep that together, and she's really, that's really the only villainous sort of timeline that we have to follow. It's hard to even say villainous.
Right, because she's not even that evil. Like, she, I mean, she's a part of the Empire, and, you know, she tortures Wedge.
Which, you know, for us is bad.
I guess. I mean, there's, they, I think they do.
It's all
a
perspective,
good,
though.
Wendig makes a good effort in this book to kind of, not necessarily humanize, but like, what is it? Just make it clear that they are self-aware. The Imperials are self-aware in this book. You know, you have less, you have minor villains in this. One is Lydia Shale. She's another high-ranking Imperial. She's more of a realist. You know, she's contending. She's having an argument with another Imperial general about who's like really enthralled with the dark side and what the Emperor was doing. And Lydia Shale, this minor character, just kind of says, "Oh, well, we built something called the Death Star. We followed this crazy," and she calls him a decrepit old goblin. That's Emperor Palpatine she's referencing. "We followed a decrepit old goblin in his ancient religion, you know." So the Imperials, at least some of them, are very, like, they're aware that they're an awful entity, and that the rebels pretty much deserve, you know, all the good light they're being painted in, because, you know, the Imperials perform mass executions. They perform enslavement of entire species, you know.
Yeah. It's bringing the attention to this greater problem that, you know, the Empire itself is a terrible entity made up of good people, or, you know, made up of a lot of different people, but not all of them are bad. And I think that's more or less the main point that Lost Stars tries to make. But it's brought up and summed up really well by everything that Lydia Shale and others are saying in this meeting, where basically it's like, we brought the destruction upon ourselves. You know, some of them are for basically just like saying screw it and letting the Empire fall, while the others are, no, we have to keep it together. But, you know, they just want the power.
They want to be able to call themselves Emperor, you know, something like that.
Right. They want to move up themselves, and they want to put themselves in positions where, you know, they can make their own means.
There's a lot of who gets to control the Super Star Destroyer, where is it being kept? Like, they really want that Super Star Destroyer, whatever it's called.
Well, they only have so many left. You know, they're down to just a few after the Battle of Endor and then the Battle of Jakku. There's only a few remaining.
Does this take place before or after Lost Stars?
Oh, well, Lost Stars is hard because it takes place over many, many years. I don't know when this takes place in relation to the Battle of Jakku. I believe it's beforehand. I think
it makes sense.
I think it takes place before then.
Endor's pretty fresh. Yeah, and I guess this is where they start having the Imperials on the run. All right, so we have this Imperial meeting.
Yeah, this is where it begins to fall apart.
Right. And there's some other minor characters in here. Part of that Imperial meeting is the satrap from Akiva. He's like the local governor or whatever, like the president of Akiva. I don't really know.
We've also got that guy who jumps out of the transport with all of his buddies, and all of his buddies are blown up, or are they? And he's the only one that survives.
I think those are the only characters we can say in this book that concretely die, besides like the, the disposable characters.
Yeah, this is like a team of guys from
the paratroopers.
The rebellion that, yeah, paratroopers that Akbar sent down. So they're here to, was it because they had a distress signal, or because they, you know, they got word that, I think it was because Wedge sent out a transmission saying that there was a large Empire gathering here, and that they needed to send people to check it out.
He got out some message. Wedge gets out a couple messages, I think, and gets cut off both times, which is another, you know, overuse of a plot device, if I could spot another one. But yeah, he this paratrooper, they try to work him in as a character for like a couple chapters, but you have nothing to go on as far as like he puts up with a lot of pain, and he's very resourceful in a fight. I don't even remember his name. He just survives. That's really all this guy does. He might shoot a ship that people are trying to escape on.
Yeah, at the end of the thing, he fights off a bunch of stormtroopers, and he gets himself into this cannon, which he has to hotwire to function again because it got broken.
He pulls
a Han
Solo.
He fires it up just in time to fire a shot at this, I think it was like the Satrap's yacht, that everybody ends up getting like taken on because Sloane basically like kidnaps all of them and is trying to take them back to one of the Star Destroyers on the only ship that is available to them, which is this yacht.
Gets
blown to bits.
To give anybody listening like an idea of how that all, like what Jacob just described, comes to be, every character that all those plot lines that we just went through, those five or six plot lines, they all converge
at some point the book.
Oh my god, yeah, like at least halfway through the book, like
more. I'd say probably two-thirds of the way through the book is when we start seeing them come together.
Yeah, and you have everybody kind of running into each other one way or another, mostly because
literally running into each other in the streets in some cases.
Yeah, they get, each of them gets taken prisoner, and some of them meet there, and it's and so they all converge, and you have this ragtag group of makeshift rebels, and they're none of them. I mean, it's essentially Guardians of the Galaxy. That's how I kind of looked at this novel, is that you're this is just showing the Star Wars universe Guardians of the Galaxy here. If Leia, Luke, and Han weren't the Guardians of the Galaxy already of the Star Wars universe, these five or whatever people are just superheroes that just can't die.
This ragtag bunch that just kind of like meet up.
They have nothing in common. They don't work well together until they do work well together and they overcome immeasurable odds. There's some betrayal in it, you know. Nora Wexley's son snaps, Temin, in this book, you know, sells out everybody in exchange for safe passage, which, surprise, backfires on him. And he gets thrown off a building and lives. But yeah, I mean, like, this is all just one big battle. And it starts with a meeting of the Imperials and culminates in the rebels getting word of it and showing up. That's all you really need to know. That's what happens in this book. Like, the smaller things that go on underneath all this, it's just, it has no bearing on anything in the Star Wars universe.
It's hardly even character development. There's some, but there really isn't a whole lot. It's just a lot of, like, minor, I guess minor run-ins with Imperials on the streets, and then eventually it culminates in this plan that they create in the kitchen, which they just kind of gloss over until they actually put it into action. And that's where the book ramps up and you kind of get everybody joining forces, and then, you know, Wedge eventually comes into play and this other guy with the cannon comes into play, and that's all that happens. Like, that's the main story of the book. It's really actually not super complex. You know, it's kind of a fun story, but it's really not too involved. It
takes place over the course of like what, like a couple days, maybe. I can't really.
Yeah, I'd say a day, like, because I kind of judge it, because it's hard to follow all, you know, all the people that are running around. But if you're thinking about the folks that are just sitting up in the Satrap's mansion or whatever, all the Imperials just having that meeting, I think it's like a day. You know, it doesn't take long at all. So that's basically it, right? And then there are all the interludes that kind of like cut in between and make things a little more confusing.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because J.J. Abrams directed Force Awakens, and I see a lot of similarities of this structure of this book to kind of how J.J. Abrams ran things. When it came to these little interludes, every couple chapters, one or two chapters, you jump away from this main story we've described and you go look at someplace else in the galaxy that is, and it describes how the fall of the Empire is affecting this one region. And it's really fan service. These interludes, they play out like, their function in this book is kind of like the alternate reality games that you see advertised whenever J.J. Abrams does anything. Like when Cloverfield was coming out and they had all that like Slusho campaign and like the Taggaruto or whatever, the mining company, all the stuff that went along with Cloverfield and all the stuff that went along with Lost and Alias. Like there are all these loose ends that really don't factor into the story in the end. You may see like a sign for Slusho at like a gas mart in one scene of this movie, but there's no bearing on the plot. It doesn't help anything. And like,
they're more like, meanwhile in Jakku, cutaways. They're just little cutaways.
They're vignettes, but if you put them into a cinematic perspective, they would totally ruin a movie for you.
Oh yeah, this is the stuff that would get on the cutting room floor because it bears no.
I don't even think you could persuade a film studio to film these scenes in the context of a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, it's not worth the budget.
Because of all the actors you'd be investing in FaceTime and dialogue, you know, these aren't like wordless parts you're thinking of here. These are just like, these are drawn out conversations, crazy settings. And I mean, like, they dig really far into the canon here, like the known canon. They go back to the Clone Wars, and they actually reference not just the Clone Wars in general. They reference a really specific character from a Clone Wars episode. I think it's season 2 or 3. This episode called The Deserter, where a bunch of the clones show up on some planet, and they find this clone that deserted the war, and he started a family. Has a couple kids, and they go into this whole thing and how he's really a good guy, and even though he deserted, and he loves his brothers just as much as the other guys do. But yeah, they reference this guy in one scene. You know, there's this very, very kind of melodramatic confrontation between two brothers. One's a rebel and one's an imperial, and the dad is standing between them, and he's like, "Old man Cut down the road, he left the Clone Wars, and you know, now he's living here. Like, it's a way to get out of, there's a way to get out of this war." Mm-hmm. And I immediately googled that, and I find out, oh, of course, it's the same deserter from the Clone Wars. It's like an odd tie-in, because that episode seems super inconsequential, as many of those episodes are.
Well, it's just one of those things where I think Chuck Wendig's trying to build intrigue. You know, he's like, oh, look, you know, I can write a cool Star Wars book with neat tie-ins too. And he just like references this bit from the Clone Wars that most people aren't going to remember unless they happen to Google it. And that's fine. You know, I think that's interesting. I think that's kind of cool. You know, it gives you a little bit of a look at the rest of the universe, and that's neat.
This should have been honestly published in a group of short stories. Like, Wendig should have saved all of these and just thrown them into a short story group.
Well, I think that's what he's doing. And I think he's just dragging those short stories out throughout 3 books.
You think those short stories are going to come back in the...
Oh, yeah. I don't see why else he would do it. I think these stories have to come back into play later. I don't know if the characters will play bigger roles in the main story. I think some of them might. But I think he's just sort of... He wants... I think maybe he didn't want to write one book. He wanted to write a bunch of books, and they're like, look, we'll give you 3 books to write one main story, and you can toss in as many little bits as you want, as long as they're not, like, super big.
I would be willing to take a bet that some of these characters don't come back in other books. I don't think these vignettes are going to be of consequence.
Then that'll make me even more mad at this first book, because why waste the time?
We'll have to wait till the next one comes out to see. But that's what
I mean.
It's
not long. It's coming out, I believe, in the next month or so.
Sweet. So it took him another 30 days to write it.
Yeah, he's probably got the third one done too.
Yeah, I mean, they Wendig definitely had some insight into Force Awakens for this one too. They referenced Jakku. They do a little vignette there. And something that references Rey, you know, there's a quote in this one. One drifter's talking to another, you know, most folk just end up here, jettison like so much worthless cargo, drop like waste. And that is kind of what Rey does in Force Awakens. I mean, that's what happens to Rey in Force Awakens. She just, but she kind of like, she's fighting that in her head about thinking that about herself. She believes her family's coming back to her, that she's not waste. And
yeah, I think maybe that would bear more weight if you had read this before seeing The Force Awakens. You know, this was part of the Journey to the Force Awakens book program. So
yeah,
this had come out beforehand. And if you kind of remember that bit about Jakku, it might give you a little more insight to Rey as you're learning more about her in the first few scenes of The Force Awakens. But I think one of my favorite cutaways from this book was on another desert planet called Tatooine.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah. You might remember that during one of the original trilogy films, there was this Mando Merc named Boba Fett. And he was kind of helping out Jabba the Hutt during the extermination of Luke Skywalker and Han Solo and Chewbacca. And he's kind of on one of these barges, and he eventually fell into this big thing called the Sarlacc. Do you remember this?
I remember the Sarlacc pit, and I remember the EU when he didn't actually die. Ugh, I guess it's not a new thing to not kill characters.
Right. Well, it seems that maybe he isn't dead in canon either. I know that this is something that George Lucas hinted at, that he didn't intend for Boba Fett to be gone forever, but it seems as if he is being resurrected.
I don't believe that for 2 seconds. I think that interlude is to say that Boba Fett is definitely dead in this.
Is it?
I mean, the scene we're talking about here is this traitor. They're looking over some junk, and they find Boba Fett's Mandalorian armor, and it's just a shell. There's no innards inside of it. I just think it's just undigestible armor, and that it got spit back out after Boba Fett's dead.
I can't see the Sarlacc just spitting it out. Maybe the Sarlacc died, and someone went down inside to see if they could find any goodies, and they found this Mandalorian armor.
In the EU, we get spit out of the Sarlacc.
Yeah, but he lives.
Right, but I'm just saying he was digested. It's kind of like owl pellets. You know what owl pellets are?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who's not in the know about owl pellets, owls will eat a mouse and then just vomit back up all the bones. So, because they can't digest that stuff. And it's just a big clump of disgusting. We dissected them in elementary school, so that's the only reason I know. I found a vole skull.
If my mom listens to this episode, she's going to love you. She's a naturalist. That's her job. She does this kind of stuff in nature and teaches kids all about it. So if she hears this, she's going to be like, hey, that Mike friend of yours, he's an all right guy. He knows about his owl pellets.
She was the best part of every elementary school student's career.
Yeah, so who knows? Maybe he's back, maybe he's not. If not, I still thought it was kind of cool to just say that, like, some Jawas found this Mandalorian armor in the middle of the Tatooine desert, and they're just kind of have it floating around in one of their little transports. But
yeah, I mean, there's some other familiar characters in these interludes, I mean, that again are kind of nice but also distracting. You got Lobot, Lando Calrissian's little robot friend, which if you're reading the comic books, Lobot makes some appearances too in the Lando comic series, but I don't even think Lobot appears in this book. They just reference him very briefly. It's all fan service here, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's why we got that little bit about Han and Chewie.
Yeah, Han and Chewie have an interlude in this book too. What are they going to do? Go rescue some Wookiees?
Yeah, they got a call from a friend who said that they had a very short window to basically free the Wookiees on Kashyyyk, because at this point Kashyyyk is still under Imperial rule and the Wookiees have been enslaved and they're being forced to do like terrible labor in the mines, and Chewie has always wanted to do something about it, and it seems like this is their chance. So they're kind of rallying a bunch of troops of ragtag smugglers and Wookiees that they can get together to go free the Wookiees, and that's kind of where it's left off. That's why I think that Aftermath Life Debt is actually going to focus a little more on Han and Chewie than it does the characters that we're focused on in this book.
Oh my god, which sort of infuriates me, because what was the point of bringing this ragtag group together?
Well, I think they'll play a part. Who knows, maybe they'll join up.
Yeah, do you think they're going to be the liberators of Kashyyyk?
Yeah, you can't just bring up that Han and Chewie are getting a bunch of Wookiees together to free everybody else on Kashyyyk. Like, that's kind of a huge story. That's an awesome story, and I want to hear that. And if he kind of glosses over it or just tells it as, like, the side story, I'd be a little mad. I would rather read about that than these characters, which I still really don't care that much about, doing something else for the Rebellion. Because we're not even sure that's what Temin wants to do, like, he still has all of his junk. Like, he doesn't, like, it was never expressly said whether or not Temin and Jazz and Singer wanted to, like, join the Rebellion and continue to fight the Empire. Like, they just got out of this thing alive. It's not like they all committed to doing this to take down the Empire. They were just, like, basically trying to save their own skins.
Yeah, I think that's a huge hole to Temin's character and a detriment to the plot of this is, I mentioned before Nora Wexley, Temin's mother. She's the one that dies twice in A TIE Fighter but doesn't actually die. I actually felt like I got it when I first thought, the first time I thought she was dead, mm-hmm. when she crashes her TIE Fighter there's no ejector seat. Because I was like, oh, this is it. This is what gets Temin to rebel. This is what gets him to join up and to believe that the Empire and all its derivatives are a terrible thing and that he has to fight against them. It's because his mother gave her life not once but twice.
Yeah, but he doesn't even show affection for his mother until he thinks that she's dead.
Which is what I thought made total sense. And I was like, oh, well, this is how Snaps Wexley becomes a character in The Force Awakens. Is because he's so moved by his mother's death and her selflessness that he has to reflect that, and that he sees how selfish he was being by wanting to remain on Akiva and not go with her and not love her. And the fact that Wendig brought her back not once but twice totally deprive this character of having that moment. And maybe it's cliche. Maybe it's cliche to give a character like, well, the only way he could have joined the army is if, you know, like his best friend died in combat or something like that. Maybe it's cliche to do that. But I mean, Star Wars is full of cliches, and you know, it would have made a lot more sense from a character development perspective to actually kill Nora. I don't see the benefit of leaving her alive at all at the end of this book, besides making people happy that they got, like, you know, their Disney ending here.
Yeah, I think his motivations are a lot like Poe Dameron's. You know, they have a pretty similar background. Poe's parents were also members of the Rebellion, and, you know, that's kind of how he ended up getting involved. That's all that I've basically read from Bloodline. That was in the Before the Awakening book, I believe, and in the Shattered Empire comics, which are both really good. I'm not sure exactly what the motivations are of most of the main characters, so it's hard to say whether or not they're gonna play a major role in Aftermath 2, in Aftermath 3. I kind of hope that Han and Chewie make a reoccurring role, because I think that's a story that I'd actually like to hear. Whereas ones like that kid Jack, who was at the beginning of the book with his father, through, you know, throwing stones and pulling down the Emperor bust or whatever that was in the middle of the Coruscant Square.
Was that the one where the kids are getting adopted, or is that was on
Naboo?
No,
he ends up. Yeah, he ends up teaming up with those kids. The kid from the first part of the book with his dad, he ends up teaming up with the Ankle Biter Brigade.
Which is just a stupid name.
It's really bad. It's like a bunch of orphans who like want to fight the Empire, and they like run around in the sewers of Cocoa Town.
That's a George Lucas name if I ever heard one. That is something straight out of the mind of George.
I mean, all the names in that story kind of bother me. Ankle Biter Brigade, Cocoa Town, which is
the Little Rascals.
The area of town of Coruscant where Dex's diner is located. And come on, like, Dex?
That's the Greek diner? Is that the one where Obi-Wan goes?
And he's like his buddy who's like a weapons expert.
That has a mustache. Little mustache.
Yeah. So that's not one that I'm like super keen on learning more about. I think that the slave bit with like a bunch of those slaves that were getting freed in that mining town, where they let the Rancors loose to like fight the Empire when everybody was rising up. I thought that was kind of neat, but I think that's going to tie into the Han and Chewie thing.
Well, that was a really cool moment too. And again, I'm not saying these interludes suck. That's the last thing I'm saying here. I'm saying that in the context they suck. But like that was a really great moment at the end of that, the sentiment at the end of that interlude when all these slaves are just kind of like, they kind of look around, like they see everything just went from 0 to 60 around them in a second and then cooled down. And the rebels are kind of surrounding them and they're walking amongst the rebels and they're like, well, what do we do now? And the rebels are just like, I don't know, but you're not slaves anymore, so do whatever you want. Like that was a really cool, like, just sentiment.
Well, it's kind of a sad sentiment because it's basically like, you know, the rebels kind of come through and they're freeing all these people from the tyranny of the Empire, but they don't have a plan for these people. You know, they're not like telling them what to do. They're not giving them any options. They're just like, well, you know, we freed you. Yeah. You're on your own.
I read it as more hopeful, but I definitely see that side of it too, though, that they're definitely just like, they're just superheroes that are kind of just saving people mindlessly and not really thinking like, oh, Spider-Man just webbed up that person that was falling, and now that person is just webbed on the side of a building.
Yeah. That's kind of how I think of it more like after, you know, troops come back from war. Like,
okay, you know, that's a more realistic application of that.
Yeah. I mean, they're in these terrible conditions, you know, fighting for their lives every day, just trying to stay alive. And then when the war's over, like, what do they do? You know, like, where do they go? Most of them probably don't have families anymore. A lot of them probably don't even have homes. Yeah, they're refugees. They have no idea like what to do at this point. I thought that was like really sad, but I liked the part where the Rancors went loose and started tearing people up.
Yeah, Rancors are always great. Even in Courtship of Princess Leia, I had a good time with those Rancors, as bad as that book was.
We should do an audiobook for that. You and I should narrate that book.
Can I be the old shriveled woman? Oh my god.
Sure. You can be all the female characters that you like, mate. You can do it all.
That's just all I remember, is that there's a knight sister who just opens up her robe or whatever and just shows Han Solo her saggy boobs, and it's just not even saggy. I think they describe her as like shriveled, and I'm like, oh, why are they talking about boobs in Star Wars? This is so bad. This is so bad.
And man, you wonder why they just let the EU go.
Yeah, because they talked about shriveled boobs, and that's why.
All right, two more cutscenes to talk about before we start to wrap this thing up. One, Mon Mothma. She makes an appearance here because why not? And, you know, it's another one of those kind of sad parts about after the war, where Mon Mothma is walking through a town that was basically destroyed by battle. And she's just looking around and she's like seeing the results of war. And, you know, the one guy is saying like this wouldn't happen if we kept up a standing military. And she's like, you know, that makes us no different than the Empire. And basically that's when she decides to demilitarize the Senate. So she basically just gets rid of their standing army, which is what eventually breathes life into the resistance, which is sort of like a, you know, the rebellion 2.0.
That's when does she see the prisoners there, and she's kind of like uncuff them or something like that. Does that happen?
Yeah, I think that happens. Is this was that the cutaway too, where there was like a bus of students that were heading towards
different one?
Okay, that was another one. I just remembered that there was like a bus of students that were heading towards the academy. This is like, was this one of the Imperial academies or something?
Yeah, the Imperial academies.
And they basically got turned around by rebels because they shut it down and, like, you know, destroyed everything. And they, like, turned it around. And the kid, like, the one kid was, like, pissed off. Because there's, like, nothing else for him to do. Like, that's what they were going to do. They were being taken out of, like, crappy home situations and, like, going to this place where they were going to learn. And, like, you know, whether or not they were joining the Empire, that's really not important. It's more or less that, like, the entire galaxy is now in flux because the source of power has been effectively just brought to its knees, and now there's no real order, and they're still trying to get that all together to create the new republic. But in the meantime, like, what are all these people supposed to do? All these civilians who, you know, no longer have jobs or purpose. Like, they're just kind of like in limbo.
Again, like the slaves in the previous one.
Yeah.
And then there was that last scene about Vader's lightsaber makes maybe an appearance.
Yeah, this was weird. It's like this group of it described them as youth, right? Like, these were young people, sort of just odd people. They're young, and they described themselves as the acolytes of the beyond.
You know what these are? These are just goths.
Teenage
goths, and they're just putting on some cyberpunk music and slam dancing with glow sticks in the scene. That is all that's going on in this little interlude.
Yeah, I imagine them, like, you know, all wearing black, and like they have like their nails painted all black, and they have black lipstick. They're wearing robes, and basically they're just, you know, they're Vader fanboys.
Yeah, they found the equivalent of what's like a murdered chicken, and they're calling it like a satanic ritual or something like that. They found a lightsaber and they're claiming it's Darth Vader's. This is just like,
or they're like Nirvana fans who found like Kurt Cobain's leather jacket. You know,
and they found it. No, they found this. They found a leather jacket at a thrift store in Seattle, and they said this was Kurt Cobain's once. We have to go sell this on eBay.
Yeah, so they buy this lightsaber from this dealer who has this, like, you know, red-bladed lightsaber, and he's like, look, I don't even know if this is really Vader's, and they're like, like, could be.
They just want it. They don't care if it's Vader's or not. I mean, they don't even have a doubt in their mind that it's Vader's or not. They're going to destroy it, they say, right? They're going to go destroy the lightsaber.
They want to reunite it with its master in the afterlife.
And that's a wrap on Darth Vader's lightsaber.
And that's it. Ties it all together. I mean, this is obviously like, I mean, the guy says it himself when he shrugs and like, says, I don't know. Like, could this possibly be Darth Vader's lightsaber? How'd that even make sense? The last time he had it, he was on the Death Star, which blew up. So whether or not Luke had thought about grabbing his father's, you know, killer lightsaber to bring him on the ship and burn him, like, who knows? I mean, who knows how Kylo Ren got a hold of the helmet? You know, maybe it was with that too, and all this stuff got found and it got auctioned off. But in the end, like, who really cares? Like, especially if these guys are going to destroy it, who gives a damn?
Here's the thing. I do care. I do care about all of this. I care about everything that led from Return of the Jedi to The Force Awakens. I totally do. I just don't care about it in the context of this book. Like, mm-hmm. I would love a collection of these little shorts about, and just call it, you know, I mean, that is Aftermath, you know, and then this,
yeah.
And then this big story, and like just sandwiching it all in between there. It was very frustrating to read, and it was,
that's a good point, man. I mean, I think you actually like hit it on the head right there. Like, it's the interludes that are really the aftermath.
Right. You and know? This thing that happens here is just like a really close look at one of those stories. Like, he came up with like 30 stories and was like, these are the characters that I'm going to follow. The mm-hmm. most, like, the most characters. He couldn't have just followed one of the plot lines with, you know, those kids trying to get Vader's lightsaber. He couldn't follow Boba Fett again. He couldn't follow Han and Chewie yet. He's like, this is the only one that I can really expand upon, and he did it. And mm-hmm. he didn't do a bad job. It's so much.
Yeah.
It's exhausting, and that's what it is. And yeah. and ultimately, where does it go? And that's what I want to address before we kind of make our final evaluations, is just, where does this go? This mm-hmm. goes to a spot at the end of this book where we get Ray Sloane, the general, which I didn't mention this earlier, but it was really confusing having someone named Ray in this book. Was that, I mean, obviously you know who's who, but having a Rey that's an Imperial general and you have Rey from Force Awakens, mm-hmm. it was a weird adjustment to make mentally. And I thought kind of out of left field to have like two characters named Rey. Am I off there? Or?
There are only so many names. I mean, you've got a Jazz and a Jack in this book. It's the same name with one letter difference.
I mean, so is this one, but they're actually phonetically the same thing, right?
Or right, but at least this one has a last name and an Imperial job.
Right, right. Latest in the rumor mill, is Rey Sloane Rey from The Force Awakens? No, she is not. So where does this book go? Where we end up is we have this kind of pseudo-reveal. Kind of like the like, oh, like where everybody grabs their, like, oh, is that really the case? So you have some of the Imperials talking together, and they're saying, like, there's just some weird kind of backstabbing stuff going on, and they're all hypothesizing and saying, was this the plan all along, to have all, like, the Imperials turn against each other in this kind of mess that gets created from this meeting? And this reveal comes, it's like, he is not dead after all. And as a reader, you're like, who isn't dead? Like, who are they referring to? Is it Darth Vader? Is it the Emperor? Is it Grand Moff Tarkin? Like, who is this person? And you're like, this is a great cliffhanger. Like, that's what I thought when I read this part. I'm like, finally, something narratively that it is going to make me want to read more. Like, this is like what I imagine they wanted the end of The Phantom Menace to be, when they're like, well, who is the Sith and who is the apprentice? You know, who's the master? Which was not a mystery at all. But this is what I imagine they wanted that feeling to be, is just like, who is alive? And just like episode one, they just turn it on its face and they don't care. The next chapter starts and it's just a fleet officer, a nameless fleet officer. And I don't believe that the name matters. I mean, what if it could be Hux? Theories.
Yeah,
it could be Hux. Is Hux a theory?
No, because I think Hux came up through the First Order and not the Empire.
Okay. So it's not a Hux. And this sounds like a tenured fleet officer. You know, like, who could it be?
Well, he's an admiral. So, you know, take that for what you will.
Are you saying Thrawn?
I'm not saying anything. I'm not saying Thrawn. I'm not saying Snoke.
Thrawn is gone. I'm saying Thrawn is gone. That's my third bet of this episode.
Who knows?
Boba Fett's gone. None of these characters are coming back in the next book, and Thrawn is not going to be part of this universe.
Look, if Thrawn isn't going to be in Rogue One, he could be in the books, and he could be.
No, because then they owe Zahn. They owe Timothy Zahn his royalties if they bring in his character.
That's fine. They license the. The work, I'm sure they can use it. I'm sure there's something in the contract.
We'll see. I mean, that's how the book ends for the Imperials. The book ends for the Rebels. They're all, again, a ragtag group. Everyone decides to be a rebel, even the bounty hunter and the former Imperial loyalty officer. And they're all like, well, you guys want to go on more adventures? And they're like, all right, Guardians of the Galaxy out. Let's do this. And they start playing the Jackson 5 and, you know, Groot starts dancing. And that's the closing scene is everybody's happy and going on adventures in this book, which is definitely a feel-good ending, just like it was in Guardians of the Galaxy.
So how do you feel about this book overall? What are your thoughts about the book?
Well, the last book we read was Weapon of a Jedi, which mm-hmm. was a young adult novel, which I totally misjudged and jumped into that book thinking it was something else. This book, I was super happy to see that it was written for adults, or, you know, like people our age, late 20s, mid 20s, children, like teenagers too, and fans of the Star Wars in general. Mm-hmm. So the same question we asked of Weapon of a Jedi, I'm going to ask of this one, and that is the question, is this worth reading? And because, like, here's the thing. I totally empathize with the way that Chuck Wendig kind of has to deal with people who aren't into his writing, and I understand that he has to, you know, he's responsible for, like, creating the new canon, and mm-hmm. and the way that people interpret that. And I don't want to be, I'm not mad at Chuck Wendig for doing anything in this book besides his writing style. And I feel like that's almost a more offensive thing. And it's not personal at all. I don't know the guy. And I think he is a fine writer. I mean, I'm harsh on the way he put this book together, but you may not like his writing style, but I love it. I'm babbling, but, like, is this book worth reading? Yes, if you want to see the vignettes, if you want the interludes.
But the interludes are also, like, just a sixth of the book, you know?
Right, right. And so
reading the book?
It's not worth reading the book, no. But I think it is worth it to get a glimpse of what happens to the Empire after. Because, you know, the EU had, like, I think three different versions of the same stuff happening and all contradictory. Mm-hmm. And finally, here we have, you know, like, the official Disney Lucasfilm canon, and here it is. And I think, yeah, it's important to know what happens if you're a fan of the history. But is this going to have any bearing on the characters you love? Is this going to have any bearing on the Force Awakens characters? No. So yes, it is worth it for those of you who are curious to know what happened to the Empire afterwards. But for those of you who are just fans of the movie, which I you know, like, people like my mother should never, ever read this book, because it's kind of what the EU was. It's fan fiction, but it's been given a more weight because it's licensed, you know? Yeah. It's just these minor characters that are given a major story.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your thoughts?
Well, let me put it this way. Jared Petty from IGN reviewed the book when it came out, and he called it mediocre. He said it was well-written, but ultimately disappointing. I kind of feel the opposite of him on that point. I think it was not well-written. I think that the writing really took me out of the story, which made it really hard to empathize or become invested in the characters that he was writing. I don't think that the characters are necessarily bad characters. I think that some of them are really great or have the potential to be great. We just really didn't get enough of them. And what we did get, I didn't feel connected to. And I think a lot of that was because of the writing. He said that the novel lacks substance, and I would have to agree with that. I think really the story that was told holds very little bearing in the main storyline that we've been following in the films. I think really this book doesn't matter too much to the story, and if you're looking to get as much of the story as you can skip this. I think if you want to learn more about the Empire and the fall of the Empire, you're going to get a lot more from Lost Stars. I think that book is really going to give you a better look. And then Bloodline gives you the look after Lost Stars, kind of looking at the beginning of the First Order and how it starts to grow. So if that's what you're interested in, go read those two books by Claudia Gray instead. This one I think you can skip, because as much as I kind of like the ideas that are presented in the interludes throughout this book, it's not worth reading through the rest, because really they're short. They're very short. The interludes are generally just a few pages long. They're not really, it's not really story. It's just kind of like a quick glimpse at something else that's going on. So for me, I didn't like Aftermath much. I will continue to read the books, and I'm hoping that things start to tie in a little bit better later. And I think that hopefully the story will become a little more important to how everything kind of plays out in the general fall of the Empire and perhaps the liberation of the Wookiees and, you know, things that I care about. Mm-hmm. From former media, but there's nothing from this book that I really felt attached to enough to follow along in the next book. So I'm actually hoping that he writes about something different, because if it's more of this, honestly, I really don't care.
Well, in Wendig's defense, and maybe this is my own fault for projecting my expectations onto this book before I even started it. You know, I said thought it was the Battle of Jakku. I mean, maybe Wendig wasn't brought into this to write something mind-altering, to universe-changing for Star Wars. He got this book deal off of hard work, no doubt there, like, and his previous accolades and writing. But he got this off a tweet, you know, and like tweet and some networking, and he output this book in 45 days.
Hey,
you know,
that's like, great. Most of the best jobs that I've ever had, I got through tweets, you know? And meeting people on Twitter. I think it's awesome.
I get it. But this wasn't J.J. Abrams being approached and being like, listen, you did great things for the Star Trek franchise. What do you think about doing Star Wars? And J.J. Abrams just being like, okay. All right, let's do this. Like, this isn't that. This is a writer, you know, who's up and coming. I definitely think he's up and coming. And being like, hey, let me write some Star Wars. And they're like, okay. You can write some Star Wars. Just don't mess with our movies at all. And this is his shot to like kind of write something and get the lore started. This is going to like, I mean, this, what I, you know, like jokingly called fan fiction a minute ago, this is going to be get tons more fan fiction. You know, these are characters that he's creating that undoubtedly they're going to, you know, get some weird like slash fic going between like Jazz and Singer and Temin being like, I don't even want to go there, but you know, this is the beginning of the new extended universe.
Yeah.
And it, I think that's what this is. This is just like, Wendig doesn't have to be thought of as like failing at creating something like massive and powerful. He's just world building right now. And for the sake of the greater franchise, and somebody's got to build that foundation. And that's why I can't be upset at this book entirely.
At the heart of it, I feel like he was given a shot based on a tweet. You know, I think he definitely thought that he had a great idea for a book. And then once it went in production and he got to talking with the story group and he got kind of an idea of what he could write and what he couldn't write, you know, whether or not he was limited or not, I'm not sure. But I think that perhaps he didn't have as much as he thought he did for the full story. And I feel like this was kind of, it was kind of disappointing. It didn't seem like much. It didn't seem like a very important story, and it didn't seem very exciting. So I don't know. I'm not going to, you know, pin all of that on Wendig, because, you know, this is the first book of three, and it's possible that there's a lot more involved to it than we know right now. And I'm looking forward to seeing that. I'm also not saying that Chuck Wendig is a bad writer, because I'm sure he's a very good writer. And I don't think that all of his books are written the way that he wrote this book. I think he had a very specific idea of how he wanted to write this. You know, like we say, I think that he intended to write this with more of a screen play sort of feel, you know, something that you could sort of visualize as a movie. But I didn't like it much. I thought it was distracting, and it made it hard for me to read. So for me personally, I didn't love the book, but I think maybe others could enjoy it. But we'll have to find out. I can't really pass much judgment on it until the work is complete, and there's still two more books for that. So we'll see what happens. The next one is...
I swear to God, I'm going to pick a Star Wars book that we both like. I'm going to find one.
I think I already did. I think you're going to love Lost Stars. I really do. It's a great book.
Before, you know, Bloodline, should I read it?
I think you should read Bloodline, because I'm reading that too, and I think it would be good for us to both read a book at the same time, because I'll probably reread Lost Stars because I love it that much, and then I'll reread it at the same time that you read it. That way we'll be on the same page, because for this one, I read this months ago. I had to do a lot of studying to kind of bring it all back into my mind, but Let's read Bloodlines first. Life Debt comes out July 12th, and then Empire's End is the title of the third book, and that's set to come out in January of 2017. So pretty soon. I'm gonna say maybe it's even done being written by now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Aftermath.
Tell us what you thought of Aftermath.
Mike says read it. I say skip it, but I want to know what everybody else thinks.
Email us, banthafodderfm@gmail.com.
Yeah, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at banthafodderfm, or you can reach out to us individually if you agree with one of us and not both of us. We are at Mike Comite and at Jacob Tender on Twitter. You can find us there. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. Twitter's more fun. I think if you're going to reach out to us, send us a tweet. You know, I really like to talk to some people. We've got some cool tweets from people that have listened to the show, and some texts as well. Obviously, we have a lot of friends listening to the show, and they're always like reaching out to talk about stuff. But hit us up on Twitter. Let's open that dialogue up and start talking about it, because, you know, this book's been out for quite a while, and a lot of the the controversy that came out after this book has sort of faded away. But, you know, it's still good to talk about. I think there's probably some stuff in this book that maybe we didn't take away after our first reading. Maybe we will in a second one, but we'll give that a go after we finish some more books. I've got a whole shelf of canon novels I need to finish.
All right. I guess it's time to say goodbye. Are you ready?
Yeah, Mike, I'm ready to go.
Okay. Goodbye, Jacob. Blah, 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 blah.